This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with film director Vadim Jean about his recent documentary, In the Land of the Free.
It takes place at Angola Prison, where three Black Panthers have been in solitary confinement for a total of 100 years, thus the ironic title. We talk with Center for Constitutional Rights attorney Shane Katadal on where things are under the Obama administration with habeas corpus, Guantanamo, and preventive detention.
Are things better? Are they worse? Listen to Shane and see if this is change we can believe in.
Stay with us.
Heidi, there's been some recent news about a program called Secure Communities that relates to immigration enforcement. Now, I know that this was originally a program started by President Bush and now has been continued by President Obama. I know the program was called Secure Communities because it was aimed at undocumented workers who supposedly had committed felonies. And it was not supposed to sweep in people who were innocent of any felonies or minor crimes, and it was using local law enforcement to enforce it. There were criticisms at the time it was started that it wouldn't work, that in fact it would wind up having local law enforcement completely involved, and that it would sweep in not just those who had committed felonies, but much more. So there's some recent new material about this, Heidi. What is the update on this?
Well, Michael, first, you're absolutely right that the ICE, or the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, touted this as a program that would narrowly target what they call high-threat immigrants, and those would be individuals who committed assault or really serious, as you say, felonies. What has happened is that the Center for Constitutional Rights, along with the National Day Laborer Organization Network, and the Catherine Greenberg Immigration Justice Clinic at Benjamin Cardozo Law School, filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit in federal court back in April, and they've received the documents. And I'm not surprised to let everyone know that they do, in fact, reveal a pattern of dishonesty about how ICE portrayed this program. 79% of the people deported due to ESCOM, as it's called, were not criminals, or they were picked up for lower-level offenses. And when I say criminals, I should have said felons.
ESCOM is Secure Communities, right?
Yes.
And I understand this program is running in some over 500 cities already, and Obama plans to extend it to hundreds more. Is that
well,
right?
It's in 544 jurisdictions within a 27-state area. And yes, the plans are to put it everywhere. And I think one of the complaints, aside from the fact that they misportrayed this and that they are using it as a general sweep, sort of along the lines of what we've seen happen in Arizona recently, is that police officers, I believe, aren't able to say, no, they don't want to do this. So they are, in effect, acting as the arm of the immigration enforcement in this country.
And how do they do it? Do you know how do they? I think one way they do it is they check through computers and criminal
records. They check through criminal records if anything comes up.
Right, of course, criminal records could just have an arrest down that was dismissed.
Exactly, and that's one of the problems. So right. Someone could have been totally innocent, but this is another mechanism by which to sweep up people and to use racial profiling.
So here's a program, right, that we were told would only get the most dangerous undocumented workers that's broadly sweeping across entire populations, using local police force to do it, and just making a mockery of the claim with first the Bush administration, now the Obama administration, that somehow this program was narrowly tailored.
That's absolutely right. And I think one of the byproducts of this is going to be increased distrust of local police by individuals all around the country, because now they're acting as this enforcement arm.
So what's interesting also is here you have the Obama administration going to court to try and hold unconstitutional, which they did at least part of it, the Arizona law, which was going to allow this very kind of sweeps, even worse, and yet at the same time, his same Justice Department or ICE, his same immigration authority, is actually engaging in conduct that you could argue is very similar, just going after completely innocent non-citizens and having them deported. And so the figures again, Heidi, are what?
the program is right now operating in 544 jurisdictions. That's huge, in 27 states. So it's in a little more than half the country. And just a reminder, when they were promoting this program, Obama billed it as an effort to catch violent criminals, drug and gun smugglers, gang members, and other dangerous aliens. So again, rhetoric goes a long way, but luckily the center and other organizations dug the truth out.
And if people want more information, they can go to the Center for Constitutional Rights website, ccrjustice.org.
Michael, a couple of months ago, we talked about the hypocrisy of a plan to build a tolerance center on a Muslim cemetery. And there's been an update, I understand, in early August. What happened?
Well, the Center for Constitutional Rights and a number of other people and organizations are representing a group of Palestinians whose ancestors were buried in graves in West Jerusalem, or Jerusalem, in a cemetery called Mamilla. And the Simon Wiesenthal, quote, Center for Tolerance, like a joke it is, has been planning for a number of years to build a new Center for Tolerance, no less, on top of the grave sites of the descendants of the petitioners in the case. Rashid Khalidi, a professor at Columbia, and other members of the Khalidi family, the Nusseibeh family, he's the head of Al-Quds University, and their descendants are buried in the cemetery. And we've petitioned the UN to stop it. So far, we haven't been able to stop it. But
that's the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Right, the Center for Constitutional Rights, on behalf of various descendants of these Palestinian families, have petitioned to stop the Simon Wiesenthal Center from being built on the site and complained, of course, about desecration of sacred graves, about the taking of property that belongs to the Muslim Waqf, or the Muslim entity that controls, that should be controlling the cemetery, but of course the Israelis don't allow it to. And that petition has been pending, and things have been pretty much in a status quo. And then maybe 10 days ago, we get notice, or El Haaretz reports, and we hear other notices, that there's been new destruction going on in the cemetery, and it's taking place in the dark of night. And what happened is, after our petition was filed, the Israelis relented a bit, and on part of the cemetery where Wiesenthal wasn't going to build the new Center for Tolerance, they allowed the Muslim group, the Waqf, to come in and rebuild some of the old cemetery, fix up the grave sites, clean it up. I know when I went there, it was a complete mess because the Muslim people weren't allowed in to even fix up the graves. So they allowed them to come in. Some 150 graves were apparently replaced. And then one night, the night of August 4th, apparently the Israeli authorities, the Jerusalem authorities, went in and they tore the cemetery apart again. So what this petition does now, we've added to the petition to say, not only is, of course, the Simon Wiesenthal Center being completely outrageous, and Jerusalem and Israel outrageous for giving them the authority to build on this cemetery, but here's what they actually did recently. They just went in and they tore out the new graves that have been put in. So it's a completely egregious case, and it makes me, you know, wonder. Here's the same organizations really pushing for this Simon Wiesenthal Center and the attack on a Muslim cemetery. These are the same people, of course, who are opposing the Muslim center two blocks north of the old site of the World Trade Center. You see, the hypocrisy of it is, I guess it's not hypocritical. They destroy Muslim graves in Israel. They don't want them in downtown New York either.
No, and in fact, in addition to the recent destruction of the 150 or so recently renovated tombs, in 2009, over 1,500 graves were destroyed at the site.
Yes, a lot of that, actually, the 2009 destruction came out even after we filed the petition. To its credit, El Haaretz, the liberal Israeli newspaper, did a study that really pointed out that what happened is they took bulldozers in there and they just leveled the place. And who knows what happened to the bones? We still don't know today. And, you know, what you can't imagine, if in Israel, Jewish cemeteries are so highly protected, they're the most controversial thing to touch or move. They will spend millions to not disturb four bones, which happened recently in southern Israel. Four bones were found, or roughly that, and that millions were spent to remove the emergency room to another place so it wouldn't interfere with those bones. And they weren't even sure they were Jewish bones. They thought they were Jewish bones, so they said, we have to move it. Let's say they can move it, but then they have to move it under with religious authorities in place. Here, what they've done with the Muslim cemetery, they didn't consult the Muslim authorities. They simply went in and bulldozed the place, threw the bones around, didn't consult Muslim authorities. And, of course, under Muslim law, according to the people we've consulted and work with, this is a sacred site, and you can't just go do that. You can't move these cemeteries like that. For further information on Mamilla, you can go to the Center for Constitutional website, but all of the papers are at www.mamillacampaign.org, MAMILLA campaign.org.
Film director Vadim Jean joins us to discuss his recent documentary film, In the Land of the Free. It's about the Angola Three. As listeners may know, the Angola Three are Robert King, Albert Woodfox, and Herman Wallace. Each had arrived in the Louisiana State Penitentiary, which is also known as Angola, in the late 1960s. While in prison and in contact with Black Panthers there, the men helped build a prison chapter of the Black Panther Party. The men have spent a combined century in solitary confinement in the Angola prison. Vadim's powerful documentary explores the issues of accountability and examines the biases against the sentencing of African Americans compared to whites or Latinos. The film is narrated by Samuel L. Jackson, and it's noted that there is a pending civil lawsuit, Wilkerson, Wallace, and Woodfox versus the state of Louisiana, presently pending before the United States Supreme Court, on the issue of whether prolonged solitary confinement is inhumane and unconstitutional. This case could stop long-term solitary confinement in U.S. prisons.
Welcome, Vadim, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we're waiting anxiously to see the new film of yours, In the Land of the Free, about the Angola Three. But before we get into the details and the politics of it, tell us how you got interested in this case.
In 2002, I made a documentary series with a wonderful woman called Anita Roddick. Anita Roddick was the founder of the Body Shop Stores. And as a result of that, she and I became great friends. And that was only very shortly after she'd first met Robert King, who is the third member of the Angola Three, who had just been released from Angola prison in 2001. And so she told me about the case and kept me updated over the years. And I never really thought I could do anything. You know, I was interested, but never really thought I could do anything. And then cut forward to 2007, when she sadly passed away. And at her memorial at the Westminster Central Hall in London, in front of 3,000 people, many people came and spoke, one of whom was Robert King. And what he said was so powerful and so inspirational. And even more emotionally, he played two messages from Herman Wallace and Albert Woodfox from their solitary cells that made me realize I had to do something, because Anita's big thing was just do something. So it was like her big finger pointing at me going, the thing I want you to do is to make this film. And we walked across Westminster Bridge after the memorial to march on Shell Tower. I was with the then head of one of the big television stations in the UK, who in fact had introduced me to Anita. And I said, I've got to make the film. And the following day he rang me up and said, okay, what can I do to make it happen? And that's where it began.
And you got over to Louisiana and actually visited the prison.
I did, although they wouldn't let me film in the prison. We requested many times to go in, but they wouldn't allow us. In the end, after many telephone calls and many requests, they finally allowed us 1 hour outside the gates. But ultimately, of course, I got banned from every prison in Louisiana, which is kind of ironic given it's the highest per capita incarceration in the world. I couldn't get into a prison.
Well, we could suggest several ways to get you in. Of course, we couldn't get you out. When you went and met the two remaining men.
I've never met Herman and Albert. They wouldn't allow me to film with them. All we have are their phone calls from prison.
Well, you know their story. Share it with our listeners. How did it come to be that they joined the Black Panthers and got themselves in solitary confinement, the three of them, for a century in solitary confinement? How did that happen?
Well, the Angola Three came together in the New Orleans Parish Prison in 1970, I think. And it happened to be at a time when there was a conflict between the Black Panthers and the police in the Desire housing projects of New Orleans. And as a result of which, a number of Black Panthers were thrown into New Orleans Parish Prison. And what the prison authorities thought they could do was to neutralize the guys they call black gangsters, people like Herman and Albert, who were in the prison for being criminals, they thought if they put them all together with the Panthers, they'd neutralize each other. They'd kind of fight each other, I guess. The problem was that what happened was the Panthers educated the criminals. And that's what really happened, was that in New Orleans Parish Prison, the three of them became members of the Black Panther Party. And when they got moved from New Orleans Parish Prison to Angola, they started the first chapter of the Panthers in Angola Prison in the heart of rural Louisiana.
Do you think that because of their political activities, they were singled out and victimized?
In the early 1970s, Angola was the bloodiest prison in America. There were inmate guards with shotguns. There was homosexual rape, where new prisoners arriving on a Friday, the fresh fish would be shared amongst the older prisoners. It seems as if that was known about. You know, there are people who say that some of the prison guards were complicit, or at least in not doing anything about that. It was a terrible place to be. And Herman, Albert, and Robert, as Black Panthers, as politicized people, decided they wanted to do something about that. And so they bucked the system. They, for example, went on a hunger strike for 45 days so that the prisoners in CCR wouldn't have to eat the food off trays off the floor, just to get food slots cut. There were a lot of human rights issues within the prison that they campaigned for. And so they would have been regarded as difficult prisoners. And when in 1972, a prison guard called Brent Miller was tragically murdered, in a bit of a rush to judgment, Herman and Albert were kind of swept up along with other black radicals and accused of his murder. Robert wasn't even in the prison at the time. He was still in New Orleans. But nonetheless, when he was moved to Angola, he was put straight into CCR, where he stayed for another 29 years.
And tell us what CCR is.
CCR is lockdown. It's the solitary confinement that we talk about in the film. Herman, Albert, and Robert, between them, have spent over a century now in solitary, which means a 6-foot by 9-foot cell, 23 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Robert was told 29 years after he'd been kept in solitary that the reason they kept him in solitary all that time was because they were investigating his involvement in the murder of Brent Miller when he wasn't even in the prison.
Some would call that kind of treatment as a rising to the torture level. How were their mental states over the time that you were working on the film?
Herman, Robert, and Albert are incredible human beings. They're incredibly strong men. They're highly intelligent. They've self-educated themselves in prison. And I think they have on their side the fact that they know they're innocent. And that makes you strong. And that's made them incredibly strong. They know they didn't do what they were accused of. And if you add to that their very strong political beliefs, you know, injustice, their belief in human rights, I think that's kept them going. Robert always says, you know, I may have been in prison, but prison wasn't in me. And none of them have become institutionalized, which has meant they're a very powerful force within the prison because they refused to be beaten. They refused to be destroyed by what would destroy most people, including me. I couldn't survive what they've survived.
Now, there's some litigation going on around their conditions. I guess the case went to the Supreme Court, actually, that ruled on this case. Is that right? I'm not sure.
There is a court date about to be set. It hasn't actually gone to Supreme Court yet. Mm-hmm. It's the three of them have a civil suit against the prison and the state of Louisiana for the cruel and unusual punishment of that solitary confinement against the 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. There is a date about to be set in that case, and it'll be very interesting to see what happens.
A date for?
The civil case.
But a date in the which court?
I'm sorry, I don't
okay.
know.
It's a trial, maybe.
Oh, it's a trial, yes.
Oh,
it's
trial.
It's a civil action against the prison.
For unconstitutional treatment
yes,
in the prison.
Absolutely.
So that's one aspect. Now, what's the story with them ever, parole boards getting out, anything going on there?
The other case is, of course, the criminal case, which is their attempts to overturn Robert is free. To be clear, Robert was released because his conviction was overturned in 2001. Herman and Albert are at different stages in their legal process. So in the criminal case, which is their attempt to overturn their convictions for the murder of the prison guard, Brent Miller. Albert's conviction was overturned by the federal court in September 2008. The state of Louisiana contested the overturning. A panel of three judges in the state court Fifth Circuit is now, has been for a year and a half, considering whether or not to uphold the overturning of the conviction or whether or not to overturn the overturning. That judgment should be published any day now.
For listeners who've just tuned in, we're speaking with film director Vadim Jean, who is here in New York publicizing his film In the Land of the Free. It's in the Human Rights Film Festival. You got Samuel L. Jackson to narrate the film. So we're hoping that this film is going to be a high-profile film. What kind of reactions have you had so far here in New York to it?
The U.S. premieres have been at the Human Rights Watch Film Festival in New York. The very first screenings of the film were actually at the Human Rights Watch Film Festival in London. And they were so incredible that the Human Rights Watch invited the film to come to New York. The reaction has been extraordinary. There's a whole letter-writing campaign started, writing to Herman Albert to give them support. I think they've now received over 1,000 letters from people in the UK, largely from Scotland, whose sense of justice is so strong. There have been standing ovations because of the emotion of the film and I suppose both the inspiration and the feelings of anger that the case invokes in people. It's meant that people have reacted very, very, very strongly. One of the things that's happened is that people all over the UK are now doing their own screenings of the film to try and get people to become more aware of the case and see if they can do something. Now, I'm hoping that the same thing will happen, you know, as a result of the beginnings of people seeing it in the US, particularly, you know, from this springboard that Human Rights Watch have given us in New York.
Vadim, do you have a website that people could go to learn more about the film?
Yes, there's the website is www.inthelandofthefreefilm.com.
Angola is the largest maximum security facility in the United States. I've read that there are 5,000 inmates and 1,800 staff members there. Since you weren't able to visit really inside, how much of the film deals with the conditions there?
Well, clearly the prison has improved since 1970. I mean, in 1970, you know, prisoners could be seen stitching up their own knife wounds. You know, I mean, it's, you know, we're talking about almost an unbelievably bad condition. And also, they didn't have enough money. You know, I mean, I'm not apologizing for the prison. You know, it was a terrible, terrible place.
There was an earlier film made on this prison.
The Farm.
Yes, there's a wonderful film.
I remember seeing this.
That's right. There's a wonderful film called The Farm, which kind of shows you what the prison was like about 10 years ago. Having said that, you know, lockdown is lockdown. And, you know, if you asked Robert how much it's improved, he would probably say not as much as one would hope. You know, the reality is it's still a 6-foot by 9-foot cell. It's still 23 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, where conditions which should be a short-term punishment. Herman and Albert's solitary is supposed to be reviewed every 90 days. But more often than not, over the last now 38 years, that has constituted of a rubber stamping of that condition and not a proper review. That's the reason they have the civil case, because in my view, and although I'm English, I'm a human being, that's cruel and unusual punishment.
Who are the lawyers representing them?
The lawyers have been Scott Fleming, who was the young lawyer who picked up their case right in the beginning, straight out of law school.
That's right. He's a guild member.
That's right, yeah, and he's a wonderful man. And Nick, and the trial lawyer, I guess, I can never quite get my terms right, but Nick Trent Acosta in Louisiana has been one of the main trial lawyers. There are other lawyers now as well. George, I'll have to...
But it's been an ongoing collaborative effort.
It's an ongoing collaborative effort, and the lawyers have done a tremendous job. You know, they've got Albert's case to the point where it's been overturned. Hopefully, the 3-judge panel in the Fifth Circuit will now uphold Judge Brady's overturning. And his order was that Albert be released immediately or retried within 90 days. You know, we could hear any day now that he will be released or that he'll be retried. Or, and this would be a terrible thing, that they overturn the overturning. And then Herman is slightly further behind. He's... habeas corpus writ has just been submitted. We hope that if Albert sets precedent, we hope that that will have an impact for Herman.
And how did the making of this film impact or change your life?
Well, I've tended to be a drama director. You know, I've tended to make independent comedies, and I made a completely mad film called Jiminy Glick in Lullawood with Martin Short, you know, based on his improvising character, Jiminy Glick. If you see that film, you'll go, how could the same person then go and make In the Land of the Free? You know, I made the film for Anita because she was a great friend and one of the most inspiring people I've ever met. But it didn't take me very long from reading the trial transcripts, from meeting Robert, and hearing actually Herman and Albert speak in those telephone calls to realize that actually this was a story that just had to be told, you know. And, you know, I've made films that hopefully made people laugh and entertained them. But this film moves people in a completely different way. It makes them angry. It makes them sad. It makes them inspired to want to do things. And I think that's it's been 2 years of my life, and I will certainly go on to make other films like this if I can find an injustice or another story that I feel has to be told, but where I believe as passionately as I do in this case, that we are dealing here with people who are innocent and for whom where they've been victims of the criminal injustice system, not the criminal justice system.
Vadim, it's often said that it's very hard to make a serious movie in the United States. It's hard to get people interested in and come up with the money. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's true, and you think it's different in England?
I don't think it's any easy. I mean, I was very fortunate. There are two people in the film industry who I can go to on a smaller budget level where I can say, look, I have to make this film. And in this case, those two people agreed that this was a story that had to be told. They were David Abraham, who's now the chief executive of Channel 4 television in the UK, and Paul Brooks, who is the producer of My Big Fat Greek Wedding, and his company Gold Circle with the American money. Now, I think I was very fortunate that those are the two people who trust me as a filmmaker more than anyone else, and who, when they just read the story or knew of the story and just said, right, we've got to do something. So I think this kind of film requires that kind of goodwill. The UK release was backed by the Roddick Foundation, you know, which is obviously now run by Anita's husband, Gordon. And I think there are people out there, you know, who have the resources and the ability to want to make sure that this kind of story is told. And it's finding those people, whether they're, you know, half my money was American, half British. So it's about finding those people.
When I saw that we were going to be speaking to you today, it just reminded me that we've been talking about Angola prison in this country forever. I mean, it just seems certainly since Michael and I and Heidi became of age of lawyers 30 years ago, in this case in particular, as you said, it's 38 years.
Yeah.
Now, the person who's free is?
Robert King.
Robert. And he's getting around, because I know I was at a show at the New Museum last year, and they had made the
tears.
Hallways between floors were all meant to be built as a prison with his words and the words of the Angola Three.
Scott Fleming, the lawyer in the film, makes this point. You know, Herman and Albert are, I think, the second and third longest held prisoners in this kind of solitary confinement in the States. But who knows how many others there are. I think there was one of the big national newspapers here at some point in the last 12 months quoted that there might be up to 25,000 prisoners in the US in this kind of treatment. In other words, long-term solitary, instead of it being a short-term punishment for an infraction within the prison. Now, I don't know how many, if that's true, but I think there are certainly thousands. Now, that raises the question of, you know, what is happening in terms of the way that that solitary is reviewed every 90 days? Are those reviews really happening? And is it becoming an increasingly common practice that people are being held in that way? You know, and President Obama has said, and Hillary Clinton has said, there should be no torture on U.S. soil, which is why, you know, Guantanamo is being closed. How can this be carrying on in Angola prison with Herman and Albert?
And I think it's one of the best held secrets in this country, those conditions.
Yeah, I mean, we all pointed to Guantanamo. Our office represented the people. But we always understood that conditions in many prisons in the United States were as bad or worse than at Guantanamo. And Guantanamo, in a sense, deflected from that a bit. Tell me about the 1 hour that you're not in the 6x9 cell. What happened?
My understanding is that at some point in the 70s, all 13 people on a tier would come out together. But that caused problems. So I think my understanding now is you come out by yourself. And in that hour, you're allowed to shower or exercise by yourself in a solitary yard.
You know, that's what I suspected you would say. I wasn't sure, because that's certainly the way they run Guantanamo, that there's no interaction or mixing among the different people on a certain cell for that 1 hour, assuming they get it. At Guantanamo, they have to do it inside a building that's not really a yard. Mm. But the point that you're making is that it's 1 hour alone still.
Yes. I mean, the prisoners do talk to each other, although they're not supposed to.
Right.
They talk between the walls, between the solid walls. I mean, there's a sequence in the film where one of the things that Herman, Albert, and Robert did was they taught themselves to play chess. So they made chess pieces for from toilet paper. They got it wet and made papier-mâché toilet paper chess pieces. They used the squares of toilet paper to make chess boards on the floor, and they would shout out the moves between the cells. And they would call the moves, and I tell you what, I wouldn't want to play Herman at chess because I'd lose. but they
didn't make my common mistake of not having the black square in the right-hand corner, I hope.
That I don't know. You'd have to write to them to find out. But, they weren't supposed to do that. They're not supposed to communicate with each other. But, clearly one of the acts of defiance, I think, was and is talking to each other, even though they're supposed to be.
When can others see this film nationwide?
I wish I could tell you we had a date yet. We're trying to work out how to do the US distribution. We're also sensitive at the moment that we could hear any day the result of the judgment in Albert's case. And what we don't want to do is in any way prejudice that. And when we got the release in the UK, I was really grateful that we did do that because I felt for the first time we could start to tell the story wider. But even if we get a release here, it will only be with the aim of seeing the release of Herman and Albert. If you want to know more about the Angola 3 or the movie In the Land of the Free, you need to go to www.intheLandOfTheFreeFilm.com.
Vadim Jean, thank you very much for being on Law & Disorder.
Thanks for making this film.
Yeah.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
As it seems, the American dream ain't nothing but another calculated scheme to get us locked up, shot up and back in chains, to deny us of the future, rob our name, kept my history a mystery, but now I see, the American dream wasn't meant for me, cause Lady Liberty's a hypocrite, she lied to me, promised for freedom, education, equality, never gave me nothing but slavery, and now look at how dangerous you made me, calling me a madman, cause I'm strong and bold, with this scuffle of knowledge of the lies you told, promised me emancipation, and this new nation. All you ever gave my people was salvation. Fathers of this country never cared for me. They kept my ancestors shackled up in slavery. And Uncle Sam never did a damn thing for me. Sat lying about the facts in my history. So now I'm sitting here mad cause I'm unemployed. But the government's glad cause they enjoy it when my people are down so they can screw us around. Time to change the government now. Panther power. Panther power.
Today, we're joined by Center for Constitutional Rights staff attorney, Shane Katadul. Shane is part of our ongoing series looking at to what extent the Obama administration is continuing and conceivably making worse policies that were heavily objected to under the Bush administration. Today, Shane will talk to us about Guantanamo. He's been litigating there for a number of years, and he will specifically address the issue of habeas corpus, both at Guantanamo, Bagram, and other offshore facilities. He'll talk about preventive detention, keeping people in prison without trial, and he'll also address military commissions. Shane Katadul, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Shane, we want you to sort of give us an overall view and an update of really the post-Obama administration around what we call these national security Guantanamo issues, which are Guantanamo, habeas corpus, preventive detention, military commissions, and tell us really where we are, how we're doing, whether there's been change. We can start wherever you'd like, but maybe a good place to start is just habeas corpus, what we had won and where we are right now with that.
You know, what we won was the right to get into court and challenge the legality of your detention. We won that in the middle of 2008, and the next 6 months or so were taken up with the courts really deciding how the process was going to look, kind of deciding the framework for how these cases were going to go forward. And then President Obama comes into office and immediately announces that he's going to close Guantanamo within the year. We at CCR were probably the only group that really objected, saying a year was too long. But he said he was going to close it within a year, and he was going to create an expert task force with members from every single agency, including the Department of Defense, which was, still is and was then staffed with Bush administration people, and that this expert agency was going to decide what to do with all of the people at Guantanamo. And so, you know, several months, you know, went by, and basically in terms of the court proceedings, they have really kind of, you know, ground to a, you know, a near halt throughout the last year and a half, precisely because the courts expected that this task force was going to take care of everything. You know, while there have been about 50 cases that have gone forward, and we've won 36 of them, so about 72% of the cases, you know, by and large, we haven't had the hearings that we expected because the courts were expecting the political process to take care of these cases.
How many people are left in Guantanamo?
I think it's roughly around 180. So that's not much lower than what it was when Obama came into power, which I think the number was around 235 or so. And in fact, during his first year, he barely released more people than President Bush released during his last year in office.
So what's going to happen with those people? I mean, I know you guys are still slugging away, and what's going to happen with those people?
The first year in office has shown a sort of that what the right wing says about Obama, which is that he has basically adopted a whole bunch of the Bush administration positions, is more or less accurate. So, you know, in terms of Guantanamo, he's improved physical conditions at the prison a lot, and it's become a lot more tolerable for the detainees who were there, but they're still stuck there indefinitely. And he's resettled a good number of the people who were who the government wanted to release but couldn't send home because they were from countries like Libya or Tunisia or Uzbekistan with horrible human rights records. They were essentially seeking asylum in third countries. There has been a lot of progress on that front, but that's mostly down to European countries taking individuals in kind of out of the goodness of their hearts, in part because they wanted to contribute to the closure of Guantanamo and the end of this you know, indefinite detention without charge system. But beyond that, nothing has changed. You know, so to go over the things you mentioned at the beginning, you know, Guantanamo, you know, we still basically see stasis. There isn't much political movement, and the fact that the new president has come into power has meant that the courts haven't moved very quickly. In terms of Bagram, we've seen the president defending and successfully defending in court the old administration's position that there shouldn't be any habeas review there, even for people who were captured overseas who are not Afghans and were brought into Afghanistan. The administration said this is an active combat zone, and therefore the court shouldn't have anything to do with
it. Yeah, let's look at that for a second, because that's habeas, which is really our sort of first topic, which, as you said, was finally won in 2008. The Senate had been litigating it since 2002. Finally, though, in 2008, we won that for the Guantanamo people. But as you said, those are still being very slowed down. And even when people win it, they can't necessarily get out because the administration says you can't just release people. It's up to us in the end. And then, of course, habeas cases were brought for people at Afghanistan, but particularly people who were sent into Bagram from outside Afghanistan. And that case was won, as I recall, in a district court. And then it gets handed really to the appellate court and the Obama administration. So just give us a little more detail on what happened with
right.
that.
So it was about a month in to the new administration when the Obama DOJ said our position is the same as the Bush administration's position on Bagram. So this, along with state secret sort of assertions in one of the cases about torture rendition, these were the first instances where the Obama administration had come out and said we're taking the same legal position about executive power as the previous administration did just a month into it. And to relate Bagram to Gitmo, the number of detainees at Bagram rose at the same time that the number of detainees at Gitmo was declining. So there are about 600 people there right now. And we know about 36 of them were foreigners, and the plaintiffs in this lawsuit you mentioned were all captured outside of Afghanistan in places like Dubai or Thailand or so forth, and they were all non-Afghan citizens. So basically, you know, the government's argument had always been with Bagram that it's in an active war zone and you can't have courts interfering with the military in an active war zone, right? You know, you don't want the judges and lawyers right up at the front lines, essentially. And the plaintiff said, well, you know, that might be fine as to some people, but, you know, as to us, we were captured outside of Afghanistan. We were brought into the active combat zone, you know, expressly for the purpose of hiding us from the jurisdiction of the federal courts, just in the same way that Guantanamo was created as this place that wasn't technically within the 50 states. So, you know, the Bush administration thought that, you know, we could hide people from the oversight of the federal courts there as well. And the district court said, yes, that's right. I think it's a big problem if we allow the government to game the system by moving people into an active combat zone to hide them. And the Court of Appeals, kind of a perplexing decision by two liberal judges on the panel, said that they weren't that worried about that. You know, what they said actually was that when these guys had been there so long, 7 or 8 years, that when they were moved to Bagram, it wasn't clear that even people at Gitmo had any habeas rights. It wasn't clear until we really won in our 2008 decision.
It wasn't clear, but we were litigating it. Obviously, if you were thinking about that from the government's point of view, you were going to start checkerboarding people around to avoid Gitmo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it misses the point that ordinarily the default rule ought to be if the U.S. is holding someone, that the courts have a role, you know, sort of holding the executive accountable, making sure that the person actually, you know, did something that, you know, means that they should be, that they legally can be held. You know, and you see in Guantanamo, because they expected that there was not going to be any court review, they had no incentive to filter people before they sent them there, and that's why hundreds of people there, you know, were released over the years without charges, why most of the people who are still there we know are not going to be charged, only about 30 or so. Out of the 180 who are left, it's because most of the people brought there were innocent. They were, you know, the victims of profiling policies like, you know, the notion that we would pay $5,000 a head for anyone who was foreign in Afghanistan. And probably the same thing happened at Bagram. You know, there was a report by Major General Stone a year ago that leaked out where he said that 400 of the 600 at Bagram had done nothing to deserve their detention and should be released immediately.
So that's habeas. And I guess one point to bring up on this Guantanamo habeas issue, I guess there's two. One is this task force report that I want you to talk about, the leak of that. I guess that's relevant. The second is Thompson and the idea that we were going to move them all to a prison in the United States. So what's this task force report?
Sure. The task force that Obama created, again, it was a way of sort of depoliticizing the issue. You know, he was going to create essentially an expert body that was going to handle the question of what should happen with each person at Guantanamo, and then he wasn't, you know, that would insulate him from political responsibility for saying, you know, essentially that mistakes were made, and we had some, you know, people who were detained for years who shouldn't have been detained, and that was why we were closing the place down. And it's a typical strategy, right, of executives. It's what people complain about in terms of independent agencies all the time, right, that it's a means of, you know, foisting off on experts the responsibility for making hard political choices. But, you know, it's interesting to read the final report of this group. First of all, they cleared most of the people who are still at Guantanamo, so I think it's roughly about 110 out of that 180 are cleared for transfer. But there are a couple striking things about it. First of all, if you look at the report, they break people down into groups. You know, so only 10% of people were leaders of Al-Qaeda. About 20% maybe had some sort of role in, you know, logistics or, you know, providing services or something like that. You know, maybe 10% were in the, you know, the Taliban leadership. But the 60 or 70% who were left, the report says, well, they're all low-level foreign fighters. So the interesting thing about that is that it implies that nobody is actually innocent. Nobody's there wrongfully. And yet this last week, we saw a case where a judge ordered somebody released because he was essentially at a guest house that the Pakistanis and Americans made a mistaken raid on the same day that they, I believe, captured Abu Zubaydah at a different guest house. And so this kid and a bunch of other students, you know, who are all teenagers, have been at Gitmo for 8 years because of this wrongful raid with no real evidence against them. You know, the report does say that that President Obama is planning on keeping people in indefinite detention without charge, the so-called people who are too dangerous but can't be tried or charged. It's interesting. It says that, you know, some of them are, you know, had some, you know, position or role in Al-Qaeda, but no role in any terrorist plot. And then it says that others were there, you know, essentially because of their expressed intent to engage in activity, hostile activity against Americans after they leave, which may just be, you know, yelling at guards and threatening, I'm going to kill you when I get out, that kind of thing, or because of their history of associations with extremist activity. So, you know, again, the determination that somebody is dangerous enough to mean that they should be held without charges implies, obviously, that there's no evidence that they can really use against a person. And you know, as you would expect in that sort of circumstance, a lot of the reason they want to hold on to them is because of associations people had through family members is one thing that was mentioned in the report, through quote-unquote extremist organizations is another.
So this is all preventive detention, right? I mean, that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, and classic preventive detention, right, on sort of the, you know, not based on real evidence of wrongdoing, but based on association.
Shane, let me ask you this, and let me remind our audience, we're speaking with Shane Katyal, who is a Center for Constitutional Rights litigator and an expert on these questions. Shane, why should your average American care about what's going on in Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan on this issue? How does it come home?
You know, one of the more tangible ways is just that this is, you know, it does a whole lot of damage to both our sort of political credibility abroad, to our armed forces on the ground abroad, and just generally to our law enforcement efforts against terrorism to have this kind of system out there. So, you know, just to give you one example, Alberto Mora, who was a general counsel, I believe, of the Navy, testified to the Senate last year that, in his words, the number one and number two contributors to battlefield deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan are respectively the symbols of Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. because of their effectiveness, he said, in recruiting insurgents in those countries to the other side. That's one sort of very tangible sort of thing, right, that this, you know, sort of creates, you know, helps reinforce the impression overseas that the, you know, the U.S. is engaged in a war on Islam, that that is what's behind, you know, the notion of holding people without charge. You know, then beyond that, there are all the problems just in terms of the standard law enforcement, you know, sort of efforts against terrorism. So, you know, for instance, the administration has indicated that it's going to try, that it, you know, is keeping open the option of trying the 9/11 conspirators by military commission. This task force report says that, you know, out of the rest of the 25 or so people who are going to be charged, that some of them could go to military commissions. And we know from the words of this task force report itself that foreign governments have expressed to us in the past that they're more willing to cooperate with efforts to try people in federal courts, you know, sharing intelligence and evidence and that kind of thing, than they would be in a military commission system, simply because they perceive that as inherently unfair. You know, that convictions in that kind of system aren't going to have the sort of legitimacy that they would globally in terms of characterizing people who are convicted as terrorists and criminals rather than as people engaged in a political struggle with the U.S.
Well, Shane, you know, I have to say, frankly, I'm not so much concerned with making the image of the United States abroad better or facilitating their efforts over there. But what I am concerned, and my question is this, is there any chance that these kinds of practices could come home to America?
Sure. I mean, you know, one of the things that the right-winger said in, back in 2007, 2008, when it was clear that the, you know, the Democrats might retake power, is that, you know, one reason to keep, you know, alternative military justice and detention systems open is that if we let terrorists suspects into the domestic court system, we were going to see a backlash, and we're going to see those systems essentially converge, that if we didn't have a separate system, that the ordinary criminal justice system would accommodate the same kind of concerns by moving towards the rules that we see in the military justice system. And you see a lot of, you know, a lot of push for that sort of thing, despite the fact that President Obama has tried to keep all those alternative systems open, right? So we still have a military commission system. We still have indefinite detention on the scale that we had under President Bush, and yet you see measures like, you know, Lieberman proposing to strip citizenship from terrorism suspects so that they can be interrogated without Miranda warnings, or people calling for, you know, legislative reform of Miranda warnings or legislating exceptions to Miranda that might be broader than what the courts already have recognized. So you do see that sort of threat to the ordinary criminal justice system, and I suspect that that's really the main agenda of the people who have been pushing for a lot of these sort of alternative measures in terrorism cases. You know, they realize that, you know, in the big picture, projecting an image of, you know, sort of fair process is actually more effective at stopping terrorist acts than using these sort of extreme measures, just because of the legitimacy deficit that they have, the extreme measures. What they really want to do is undo the criminal process revolution of the 1960s.
That's a really strong point. Very of course, we saw it with the so-called Times Square attempted van bombing, where they immediately said we may have to, the Obama administration said we may have to expand the exception to Miranda legislatively, and we may actually have to limit presentment, which a lot of our listeners may not know, but is where you have to bring a person before a judge in 48 hours. And it's essentially saying we don't want to do that, and maybe, and that's a sort of already a form of preventive detention. But I want to ask you about Congress right now, and it's, and I follow this somewhat closely, but I'm completely mixed up, I have to say, about Congress. Originally, there was this proposal to buy a prison in Illinois called Thompson, and they were going to move Guantanamo people there. And of course, there was a mix of opinions about that, because if they were going to worsen conditions for people or just take a Guantanamo with preventive detention and military commissions and put them in Thompson, you know, a lot of people said, well, what's the big deal about that? But then Congress has gotten in the act now repeatedly. And of course, it's up to a certain point where they won't allow anybody to come to the United States unless it's for purposes of prosecution. And now there's some new legislation coming down that's even worse. So can you just give us a sense of what's going on?
Sure. Well, you know, all of it started when word leaked out that the administration was planning on potentially bringing a few Uyghur detainees, you know, who were essentially seeking asylum from China into the United States. And that was supposed to be the triggering event that would tell Europe, well, we're contributing our part to the resettlement efforts for asylum seekers, and you should do it as well. You know, word leaked out. Republicans picked up on it as an issue to beat the administration, you know, about the head with. And then it's extended since then to moving the sort of, you know, people who are just in this kind of, you know, limbo land, like most of the folks at Guantanamo, and then also an objection to moving people to the U.S. for trials. You know, and it's basically a political issue. I mean, in some sense, you know, as you mentioned, the idea of moving people to Thompson is sort of meaningless, you know. I mean, we've always said that it's the Guantanamo system that has to end and not necessarily the physical place. perhaps somebody in the Obama administration thinks that the symbol, you know, again, because of its impact overseas on the public perception of the United States and on the public perception of his administration, you know, they think that it's important to close the symbol by itself, and we don't agree.
But wasn't there some new legislation now that's going to do, one, it's, there's something about investigating lawyers, and there's even more about the stuff about bringing people to the United States, am I right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, they have to continue those measures every year, basically, because they're in the budget bill. They're measures that essentially defund any sort of attempt. You know, they bar the use of federal funds for any attempt to move people to the U.S. You know, what you see there is, you know, sort of repeated, you know, sort of extensions of these limitations, and then also notice requirements to Congress that have gotten increasingly onerous.
Yeah, the notice requirements, I just want to say that. It was at 45 days, is that right?
It varies depending on what they want to move them here for. You know, even sending somebody home requires advance notice. The thing we've always worried about is that somebody could scuttle a controversial resettlement in a third country, or repatriation by leaking word.
Yeah, that's what strikes me, is you repatriate someone to a European country or any country, and you have to notify Congress 45 days, or maybe now it's going to be 120 days.
Right.
You give the forces in that country who are opposed to a resettlement an opportunity to actually say and create a huge protest in the country, and then you're not going to be able to resettle. So it's a really self-defeating proposal.
Yeah, the other really, really controversial thing in there is a call for, I think it's the Department of Defense Inspector General to carry out an investigation of misconduct by lawyers in the course of representing people in habeas or military commissions. And this is really aimed at some of the lawyers who are part of the John Adams Project at the ACLU, where they, you know, took sort of publicly available pictures of known CIA interrogators, I believe, and showed them to some of their clients who were facing trial, I think, in the commission system. And you know, said, do you recognize this person? It's a typical sort of thing you would do in an investigation. Now, the word is that the Department of Justice looked into that and found that there was nothing, you know, wrong with that, that no crimes were committed. That ticked off the CIA, who then you know, pressured the government to Pat Fitzgerald on an investigation to look into, you know, again, the question of whether any sort of wrongdoing took place. And I'm sure the Republicans who are sponsoring this bill don't think that that investigation will be satisfactory either. So they want the Defense Department, again, which is still pretty much staffed with Bush people, to carry out its own investigation.
Yeah, no, it's really disgusting. I mean, when you think about all of the crimes committed by the lawyers in the Bush administration, you, Bybee, the torture memos, and, you know, they've been harassing the Guantanamo attorneys, you guys, for years now, and now they want to put in a congressional bill more and more investigation of Guantanamo attorneys. I mean, I find it just, I mean, there's no words for it, Shane.
You know, it's interesting. During the material support case argument at the Supreme Court on February 23rd that our board member, David Cole, did, Elena Kagan actually said that she would, you know, the government conceded that you couldn't charge someone with material support for being a lawyer to someone where there's a due process right, a habeas right, a Sixth Amendment right, something like that. And the implication is that if that sort of constitutional right wasn't clearly established, that you were exposing yourself to you know, charges of providing material support to terrorism merely by representing somebody. You know, and this is actually an issue that's come up at the international tribunals when American lawyers have tried to you know, sign on to be on the defense teams, and they've had to get, you know, dispensations from the State Department or Treasury.
Well, that's what Lynn Stewart was charged precisely with, that giving material support, because she issued a press release, which they said was beyond the pale in terms of representing somebody.
The idea there was that she had sort of provided her client as personnel, I believe, by allowing him to communicate outside of the SAM. So this is a little bit different in the sense that it's the mere act of representing someone.
Yeah, which is much worse. But
when you think about it, you know, it wasn't clear that Guantanamo detainees had any constitutional right to be in federal court until the middle of 2008. So, you know, on that theory, you know, we lawyers would have been exposing ourselves to prosecution under this statute up to that point.
That's what they'd like to do. They'd like to scare off attorneys like you or Michael from even taking up these cases. I think that was the point of prosecuting Lynn Stewart.
Yeah, definitely so. And the net, you know, sort of total of all this is that, you know, it shows that the, you know, President Obama, really, for whatever we believed about him coming into office, is really just as committed to the notion of removing checks on executive power that might, you know, sort of hold him or any future executive accountable in terms of their sort of counterterrorism strategy or their sort of law enforcement effort against terrorism. You know, so you see all the prominent lawyers who believed in checks on executive power, Don Johnson, whose nomination never got anywhere and wasn't backed by Obama, to, you know, Phil Carter and Greg Craig, who resigned from his administration. They, you know, all the people who believed in checks on executive power have left. And then, you know, the person that he nominates to the Supreme Court is someone who I think pretty clearly believes in a very strong executive as well.
You're talking about Elena Kagan. Shane, this has been
very true.
You know, quite informative and, you know, very depressing, I think, for all of us. I mean, I think we were at the center together when we started these cases in 2002, and here it's 8 years later, and you're still in deep in the trenches on these cases.
And the only place we've ever won is the Supreme Court, and unfortunately, I think you're probably looking at Kagan recusing herself from all Gitmo or detainee-related cases for probably about 2 years, which means that we're very unlikely to get any cases accepted for review up there.
Right, because you're at 4-4 at best, and that affirms whatever... The lower court in Washington has been a disaster on these cases. Well, Shane, thank you very, very much. I know you're still in there fighting. It's a remarkable work. And as you sort of closed, that one of the serious issues is to the extent that our criminal law system begins to reflect this system set up for Guantanamo and Bagram. And I think that that's a very serious issue.
For years, we've fought to get our clients, charged or released, essentially, fought to get our clients into the conventional criminal justice system. Puts to one side that there are a lot of horrible things, horrible innovations that have been created in the conventional criminal justice system that we'll have to deal with if that ever happens.
Thank you very much. We so much admire your work, and we appreciate your being a guest on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.